Accession number 28639, reel number 4.
4. Jack, could we just stop for a minute there? Okay.
Like, I was at a point where I was still in the water. I could still see people around me, including my old officer from the wireless station in Hong Kong. Now, he disappeared. Twice we tried to, the people who were with me helped me. We tried to dive to get hold of him. On two occasions we managed to bring him to the surface. And we finished up putting some of the wreckage from the ship had already joined us with under his arms to help him keep him afloat. But eventually he went in and we just couldn't find him. And we were getting so tired as well with being weak and in the heavy salt water, which it was extremely heavy salt water. As I'll tell you later on, was to save my life, because darkness was crawling, and looking back in the gloom, we could see the ship had disappeared by this time, the Lisbon Maru, but the destroyers were disappearing into oblivion. They were just leaving us to die, really, at sea. But we were still swimming towards these islands, and night time came, and by this time I was alone. I didn't know what had happened to the others, and I thought, my God, after what I've been through, is this the way I'm going to die? But I was still young enough and strong enough to keep swimming. And as I told you earlier, the sea was so buoyant with the heavy salt water, it kept you afloat. And I realised after a while that you could really let yourself go, and it was lovely, until you got a mouthful. And then, of course, it was so strong it woke you up straight away, because I was nodding off. But each time I felt panicky, I looked and these lights were getting closer, because the lights were on by this time on the island, and that kept me going, and I kept swimming slowly towards them, and all that night I kept falling off and waking up, and slowly but surely the lights seemed to be getting nearer and nearer. They didn't really, as I find out afterward, but as dawn came, I thought, oh, crummy, they're just as far away as ever, the light. And I thought, my God. And there was I alone still. And I just kept swimming around. And I thought, well, it's lovely to be free, I kept thinking to myself, away from these sadistic damn Japanese. I didn't even think of being hungry or thirsty. I never thought of it. The thought of being free was enough for me. So I thought, I was determined. So I kept stronger than ever then. I'd had a little bit of snods during the night, even though I was still floating, enough to rest me. So I started swimming towards the island, and all that day I kept taking little rests and swimming. And I did, mentally I kept thinking I was getting nearer. But then the afternoon and the evening started to approach. I was still afloat, and still trying to make these islands on periods, swimming and then resting. Falling asleep now and again, even during the day, but waking up as soon as you got a mouthful, because it was so strong, it woke you up straight away. And up to then, it still didn't make me any thirstier, the salt water. I think it was a fact, again, to remind you that I was free after that short period, albeit with the Japanese. And then night started to call in again, and I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to make it. But as the night progressed, then the light started to come closer. And I was getting mixed up. I thought, yes, but that was the same last night. And by this time it was really dark. And I thought, no, I'm not going to make it. And suddenly this light came on me. And I thought, oh, it's the Japanese. But I thought, I'll welcome anybody at this stage. And suddenly, I'll never forget this voice. This Chinese voice said, hello, I save you. And it was a Chinese fisherman from the islands I was trying to make to. And he pulled me into his boat, and then he repeated it. You very lucky man, I save you. And I said, anybody else? He said, yeah, there are plenty of people on. You're one of many people. And broken English. He could speak a bit of English, because I found out the island he was on was an archipelago, Trinity House Island, and there had been Chinese working for Trinity House who could speak English, so most of them could speak a bit of English. So I got on very well with this fisherman. I was lying on the boat, and he gave me some raw fish to eat. Anything was good enough. And water to drink on this boat. And then he said to me on the way, and he said, I'll take you. By this, he switched his light out. He said, I'll keep, because I might attract the Japanese. He light, by the way, is for his fishing. And he used to use it for fishing. So on the way, and he said, again, you're a very lucky man. I said, I know, you've told me several times before. He says, but you are a very lucky man. This sea is infested with sharks. He said, the number of people I've tried to pull out and were caught with sharks, he said, before I could get them out. He said, so you're a very lucky man. Oh, so God, I said, God is really being good to me. I kept thinking about Jesus Christ, meeting him, and my faith, you know, I hung in there, Jack. So I got back to the island. He took me out to the island, and I found 40 others on this particular island I was on. And they told us, they said, you'll need treatment for your back, because having been in the water so long during the day, I had blisters in my back with the salt water and the sun. And they treated me with some oil. And they gave us then Chinese clothes to wear. They said, don't wear them yet, because you're still in the hospital with the treatment you're giving. He says, but we'll take you to the mainland tomorrow night. He says, you'll travel by night and sleep by day, because you'll be easily identified through China, and we'll get you to Chongqing. Oh, great. So the rest of that day we spent on this island.
How many survivors were there?
Sorry?
How many other survivors did
you meet? There was 40 of us on this island, but there was many on the other islands at this stage I hadn't known about. There was about 800 of us eventually, as I found out later. But they were told us now, you go and have a sleep now. You've had plenty to eat, go and sleep. This was the same day, by the way. We'd been picked up by the Chinese fishermen, taken to sand in the morning. And on the same day, late afternoon, we'd just been told to go and have a rest when we heard the hooting of the Japanese destroyers. And we thought, oh my God, I hope it's not the same destroyer with that Namori on it again. He was the hated interpreter. Well, these destroyers landed the Marines. Fortunately, they were naval Marines, not army. And there was no army involved, fortunately. And they were very good to us. They said, we are very... Their officer could speak a bit of English. We are very sorry. We've taken you back to the destroyer. But you've got to get rid of the Chinese clothes. You can't go on board Japanese destroyer clothes. So we were reduced. We said, but you'll get some clothes when you get on the destroyer, which they did, though. So when we got to the destroyer, they put us round, there's only 40 of us in this case. We found out there was other destroyers that picked up other people, as we found out when we got to Shanghai. But at this stage, there's only the 40 of us, the 40 on. A few had died, so there was about 30 or so there on this destroyer. And they made us sit round the funnels of the destroyer to keep warm. Didn't put us below deck. And they gave us lovely fleecy blankets to put over round us. And they gave us hot milk to drink out of huge Japanese-type mugs. And we couldn't understand this treatment. We thought the war must be over.
Did they take any reprisals on the Chinese fishermen who rescued?
No, they didn't. Not that I know of. I'll tell you why. No, they didn't, because we found out later on. There was a detachment. I didn't go with them. We went back to the island to thank them for what they did to us. And they gave them a fishing motorboat, as a present from all of us, because I helped to contribute to it, the survivors. That was after the war ended. So, no, they must have left them alone, because they were Navy, and they were an army, you see, as you find out later on. Well, anyway, they took us on this destroyer. We were on this destroyer on the way into Shanghai. And on the way in, they gave us this hot milk, and they treated us very well. But when we got up into Shanghai, we went alongside, and then they told us to come up on the upper deck. And I'll never forget the young Japanese naval officer who spoke to us in English. He said, I am very sorry to have you back to our army. He said, we've done everything we can for you, but they are insisting that they take you back, because they are, after all, you're their prisoners, not ours. A lot of them had been, I'm sure this young officer who spoke to us had been trained in one of our naval establishments in England. Because he was a very mature chap, I would say in middle life, probably in his mid-40s, this Japanese officer. Anyway, going down the gangway, looking back, I could see them doing this, the officers on board the destroyer.
Making the obeisance with the hands.
Giving us, yes.
Hands clasped beneath the chin.
Some of them were Christians, by the way, by this time, as we found out. And when we got off there was a line of Japanese soldiers with Namori in charge of them, waiting for us. and they were the Japanese who had been taken off the Lisbon Maru that we had survived from. And as soon as we went down off the gangway, they just beat us with anything they had in their hands, rifle butts, everything. They just hit us as we went along. And the Maoris say, this is punishment for having tried to escape. You tried to bloody well escape, in Japanese, apart English. And we were all herded onto this wharf. The Wang Pu Wharf, it was called. I remember that now, in Shanghai. Wang Pu, P-O-O, Wang, W-H-A-N, Wang, W-H-A-N-G, P-O-O, Wang Pu Wharf in Shanghai. And that's where we found out all the other survivors from the other islands had been brought in by other Japanese naval people. And they all had the similar story to that we had told, how comparatively well they'd been treated by the Japanese Navy. And then we're put on the same day on another Japanese freighter called the Shenzhi Maru. Shenzhi Maru. And it was down into hold again, but this time we weren't batten down, but we were taken down into hold, and there was no Japanese soldiers above us. What Japanese there were on board lived on the upper deck. And we were on this on the way to Moji. So on the way up to Moji, we were allowed up to the toilet, but it was just over the side sort of thing. But we got so thirsty on the way up, they weren't allowed any water. We were given food, but oddly enough, no water. So the winches on the ship were steam-driven. So there used to be water dripping from that. So we used to take our cabs out, and the Japs allowed us to do this. The crewmen on this ship allowed us to do this. There were just a few Japanese on board as the guards. And we took water from the winches to drink. Just water, that's what we had to drink. Eventually we arrived, on the way up, by the way, every time there was a thud from the heavy waves, because there was stormy weather up here, we thought it was another British destroyer, another somebody else. But no, we eventually arrived in Moji, M-O-J-I, in the southern tip of Japan. And on the way up, we had several more died. And we had an English naval officer with us by this time, a tall called Jackson, whom I knew in Hong Kong, and he was determined that they wouldn't leave any dead bodies on the Shenzhi Maru when they got off it. But the Japanese insisted, we will get rid of these bodies for you. You are Japanese prisoners now, you do what we tell you. So they herded us into a train, and little did we know, there were cattle trucks, but little did we know at the time that we were going to be used to test out the underground tunnel between the southern tip and the main island of Hong Kong, or Hokkaido. We didn't know this, but this under tunnel has been started, apparently, during the war, and had been finished. And we were under this tunnel in this train, not knowing we were being experimented with. And we came out at the other end and into Osaka. We're taken into Osaka, and I was put in a camp there. And during the first year there, in one of the camps in the industrial area of Japan, Osaka and Kobe, 1 week I'd be working as a stevedore on the docks. The next week I'd be working in the Mitsubishi Iron and Foundry. And this went on for most of that year.
What were your impressions of Japan? I mean, this is the first time you'd seen it.
Well,
what you saw of it from the train, and I mean, did you have any contact with civilians
with civilians. We had the odd civilian look at us, but they were looking at us as a curiosity more than anything else. We didn't really get in touch with the Japanese civilians until we were in Osaka and working either in the docks or in the iron foundry, because we were people working with Japanese older people at the time.
And how were you treated?
We were treated exceptionally differently, believe me, yes. We were treated as human beings, really, by these people, to the extent that on the way there, to the Osaka docks, for example, I don't know if you know Japan in those days, very narrow streets, and the houses had overhangs, like what they call balconies, overhangs, for the sun down below, and used as balconies as well. And the ladies used to come out on these balconies and throw food to us, pieces of, now they could probably ill afford it themselves, but pieces of bread, black bread and what have you, that they had baked themselves, no doubt. And on one occasion, going to Osaka docks, there was a group coming from one of the other camps, heading presumably for the Mitsubishi iron foundries. We were going to the docks. And it's quite regular when we passed each other, the guard would stop to have a chat and we would all stop. But on this one occasion, as we were stopped to talk, and they were throwing food to us from either side, and I'm sure the guards were aware of it, but just ignored it. There was a chap, a Japanese officer on a horseback, and he was Kempeitai, had come up, and he witnessed the falling of the food. So he shouted a kura, in Japanese, which is a cruel one apparently, to the guards to get hold of those women. And they ran inside when they saw who it was, Kempeitai, because they were afraid of the Kempeitai themselves.
Kempeitai means?
Kempeitai was the equivalent to the Japanese, the German SS. They were terrified of them. They were really horrible Japanese people, even worse than their army. And that was saying something. They were really cruel people, even to their own types. And he was on this horseback and he saw what had happened. So he ordered the Japanese to get those women out, and the women ran into the houses. But that didn't satisfy them. They made the guards go up and bang on the doors and threatened to bang the doors in if they didn't come out. And they brought these women out, down in front, and beat them in front of their own flesh and blood. The guards, they beat their own women up. Now, that was horrible. I'll tell you later on that I met the daughter of one of those women just by accident later on in life. I'm still in touch with the mother who's still alive, and she's in her late 80s like me. She must have been about ages with me at the time. Now, we were taken then from there. We're on this way to Osaka camp, that was right, to the shipyard rather. And we'd seen the beating up of those poor women. And all of us just stood there open mouth. We couldn't believe what we were having to witness. We thought, how brutal can they get? And they're just beating us up. They can beat their own people up as well. So when we got to the Osaka dockyards, we were telling some of the Japanese people that I was working with.
How did you communicate?
Well, by signs, more or less, you know. Broken English, bits of...
Japanese,
like,
you
yes, right, yeah. I can give you some examples of... Fish, we talk about fish, you know, and swimming
mouth
in the water. Yes, that's
mouth.
Right, and eating them. And they were to give us bits of fish to eat. And some of the women there, the guards, used to come in and join in the fun. And this is a bit, I don't think, for your microphone, but it's up to you whether you use it or not. But they would say, now, what was the Japanese word for it now? Anyway, the sign was this.
Running a finger through a...
Yeah,
through
yeah
a
sex,
ring.
Sex, another
yes,
one.
Yes, that's right.
I can forget the Japanese word for it now, but it'll come to me in a minute now. Oh, anyway, and do this. And we used to say, sorry, sorry, no good, you know. No strength, you know.
Sorry, the Japanese women would come and...
Women, yes, but this was the guards offering us sex for their own kind. For their amusement, I no doubt.
Homosexual sex?
And this was on when we were having a rest, as stevedores on the docks.
Oh, I see.
Having a break. We had a tennis ball size of a tennis ball. That was our lunch, as stevedores. Nothing else, just that, just bare rice.
And they were
with water.
To have sex with you, man to man, or they were
no,
offering to
no,
provide
the
you women?
No, there was women stevedores as well, sorry.
I understand, oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Elderly women, because the women in those days did all sorts of heavy work, you know, the women did. Because in those days, we saw, going to and from the camp, we used to see civilians moving around the town, Osaka, and the women always had to walk behind the men. The husbands walked in front, I don't even know this. And they were never allowed to work alongside their menfolk. They had to walk behind carrying all the baggage, shopping or anything that the men had bought, had to carry a lot. They were really just second-class citizens, the men. And it was one of the stories I gave, by the way, when I went back to Japan about 6 months ago. I said, there's one good thing. One of my failing or last-minute sort of talks to a group of lady Japanese civilians before I left Japan was, there's one very good thing we did for you womenfolk in Japan, was I can recall when I was in Japan as a POW watching you poor womenfolk having to walk the men behind menfolk with your little clip-clop shoes on, carrying all the luggage or baggage. And they all laughed at this and nodded their little head. And I said, but now, I said, it's the other way around. You walk in front of the men more or less now, and, or at least level with them. And they all laughed, because most of them being Christians, they all speak. That's one thing about Japan nowadays. Most of them can speak English because of the American influence there. And I told them this, and they loved that story. I told them that. But anyway, back to this point about skivvy. Skivvy, that's the one, skivvy. That's the one, skivvy, probably a slang Japanese one.
It's meaning they were skivvy, offering, skivvy. They wanted you to have sex with them. But it was a joke,
if anyone were taken up, I suppose they'd force the women to allow it to happen. But we, none of us wanted any part. We felt like it. We didn't have the strength anyway to do it.
What was the morale of everybody now? I mean, we're now in what we...
it was a little bit better than it was on the ship, I can assure you that.
And your living accommodation, what was that like?
Well, it was. We're living still together like sardines, but it was in better accommodation. For instance, it was wooden bunks that we had in this about 2 feet off the deck, and then there was bunks above us where you had to climb up into in this camp. We had to climb down in the morning. I think it was number 2 camp I was in, but I can't remember now. They're all numbered, these camps. There were several, because that was an industrial area, and we were slave labourers at this time, labourers rather, for the Japanese.
Were you beaten again? I mean, was it so brutal? It wasn't so brutal, you were
saying.
It wasn't so brutal,
Not at this day. No, we weren't. No, because we were working for them, and they were trying to get as much out of us as they could. But there was the beating, which I'll come to shortly, if you did anything wrong. See, I always remember Nimori's first word to us in Hong Kong, the Japanese interpreter. You'll be taken to a beautiful country, which I agree it was. We found out. But if you do as you're told, you will be treated well, and that was his word. So, provided you did what we were told, and we were doing what we were told by this time, automatically, we're just treated like cattle. We just did whatever they wanted without any reaction, really, by this time.
And you worked 7 days a week?
We worked 7 days a week, yeah. There was no days off. We'd get the odd days off during afternoon, maybe, depending on the weather conditions. But on one of the occasions, coming back, but this time, by the way, the point I was at was at this camp where we were unloading fish, it was, in this case. And it was put straight onto Japanese transport. We were loading Japanese military transports and stevedores. Now, later on one of these occasions, was at Saka Docks, but on this occasion it was rice sacks we were unloading. And some of the ships were a good 30 to 40 feet above the edge of the dock. So throwing these sacks down from about 30 feet, and you had to try and catch them. Well, of course, the first sack that came down to my shoulder just bowled me over. And this guard I was on, this is my first beating as a Japanese, as a stevedore. He told me to pick up. So I tried to get the only part I could get was onto my lap. But trying to get it off my lap, and it was like jelly being rice, raw rice. And I could get it so far up to my chest, but no farther. I kept falling down, and in the end I just collapsed from sheer exhaustion. And he started to beat me on the ground to make me get up. And of course I put my legs and my arms on top of me to safeguard me. One of the times he hit me in the nose. My nose is still broken today. You see my nose broken. Too late to do anything about it when I came home. But one of the butts caught me on my kneecap, and it smashed my kneecap. But I didn't know at the time, of course, it had been badly burned. So I couldn't even get up if he wanted me to. And he realised then, the guard did. So it could have called two of the other prisoners across when it was time to go back, and I had to be helped back to the camp. But when they got back to the camp, they made me the doctors there, you have to have a splint. And they made splint with just pieces of wood and just wrapped it round with anything they could find. But it still kept me working because I could walk using that as a splint. But I was excused duty from there on from the docks. But I still had to do duties on the iron foundry, even though I had the bad leg. And that went on then for the rest of my period in Osaka.
What were you doing in the oil foundry?
In the iron foundry. Well, it's very difficult to really say what we did because all we do was just tipping metal that we got off of trucks into this huge cauldron, so it looked like. We didn't know what they were doing with them, we were probably melting them in there. But special pieces of metal that had been segregated by the Japanese, we were just tossing them or carrying them from receptacles and pushing them, just throwing them into these gates, but which were about 6 feet above the ground, but were several feet under the ground as well, at least under the roof of where we were on. They were melting cauldrons, I can only assume. No idea. That's all we were doing there. But there was other jobs which I didn't get round to, because I didn't spend, apart from the odd week, that's all I was doing there, really. Because eventually, I found out, it was after about a year. It was by this time, 1943, by this time. Towards the end of 43, there was the odd bombing of Americans from aircraft carriers, presumably, out and approaching Japan. So at the end of, towards the end of 43, this was. So, by this time, Jackson, the doctor I told you about, came to me and he said, "Jack," he said, "we can't keep you," he said, "working," he said, "like this with that leg." He said, "the Japs have just asked me to open the hospital in a place called Ichioka." He said, "you could come with me." He said, "I'm going to take people who are invalids like you with me." I said, "but I'm not a medic." He said, "there's other jobs in the hospital you can take." He said, "you can come as a patient if I can get away with it, but if I can't get away with that, because walking, you can still walk without splint." He said, "but at least you'll be an orderly of some form in this hospital." So I agreed to do this. So there was only six of us with the doctor, all naval people, by the way, went on this transport to Ichioka.
Sorry, Jack, before we go, were there deaths amongst the labourers? When you were working as stevedores and in the iron foundry, did people in your group die? I mean, were there routinely people would...
Oh, yes, they were. So weak? Yes, there was one occasion now when the bombings, from an American bombing, they bombed a dry dock, and there had been a submarine, Japanese submarine at the time. Hadn't been damaged, apparently, the submarine, but they damaged the side of the dry dock. So that had to be repaired. So they took us back, even though I had a splint, I still had to go back. And we spent all that day just carrying rubble to fill up the holes where the bomb had been dropped. Fortunately, the holes weren't terribly big, so we soon filled the rubbles up during one day. That's just one of the examples of the many jobs we did in between stevedoring. Since I had my splint on the leg. And once the rubble had been filled, then they brought cement things in. But we had to level the cement off. They just tipped it in. We'd level with our bare hands or our feet. And, of course, you can imagine what it was like with our feet and hands. It was awful. The blisters we had on our hands for ages afterwards. But by night, just getting nightfall, when we'd finished the job and were told to collect, as we were being collected, some of the Australians in the group said, "you come and help us." I said, "what do you want to do?" He said, "there's loads of Japanese tools around that they're using on the docks. Before we go back, we want all of them put in the cement while it's still melting. This is part of the, what do they call it, the anti-war thing, you see, with the Japanese." So we agreed. I even on my limp, I was only pleased to do this. He said, "you're quite safe because the Japs are busy collecting other people at the time who are doing other bombs." Right. So we were throwing all these spanners and things into the cement, and off we went back to camp feeling great of ourselves. At least we've held up their war effort a bit. Until the next morning, there was hell on, and I was singled out as one of those. And as punishment, and this is as true as I'm sitting here, they took me, splint and all, to the guardhouse of the camp. And they put a rope round my ankles, and the other length of the rope went over the overhang of the guardhouse, and they pulled me up until I was hanging upside down. And they left me like that for 2 hours. So when they eventually let me down, you can imagine how far, I just couldn't stand up. Water had gone to my head. And I was in a terrible state.
Sorry. Jack Hewison, Reel 5.